Hi everybody, my name's Dave Weiner and I'm an alcoholic. He said, I want to thank Jeff for inviting me to the group. I was here about 4 years ago, so I'm back again, and I think that's probably a good thing. That I must have done something right and continued to do something right to be back here again. And I thank you. It is a privilege to be here a second time. As I said, my home group, the Precisely How group in Bristol, Pennsylvania, we meet on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock, or same format as you guys, our speaker meeting. Love the format. My sobriety date is April 28th of 2006, and I'll just start from the beginning. I was 6 days old when my parents picked me up at the hospital. I was adopted. I was brought into a home, two people that couldn't have children, wanted a child more than anything else in the world. I was brought into a warm, loving home where they wanted me more than anything else in the world. My mother absolutely doted upon me. I had difficulties growing up, learning disabilities, type stuff like that. My mom was always there for me. I was born in Center City, Philadelphia. My dad was in advertising. He was a decent guy. Again, just a loving home. And at about 7 years old, 8 years old, we moved out to from Center City out to the suburbs. And it was a cool place. It was like a little brick house, and there were tons of kids in the neighborhood. I came from the inner city where, there weren't trees and grass and things, a lot of kids around, to just tons of kids my age. It was a fantastic place. There's a fire station down the street that had a 5 o'clock whistle. In the summer, you'd whistle go off and you'd go home. We played kick the can. We played street hockey. We played capture the flag. It was just, an ideal situation. I mean, it was wonderful. I loved it. I made it through high school with help from my mom. My mom was always just, very supportive of everything I did. I mean, if anything, she probably spoiled me with love and accolades. I made it through high school and I was, afforded the opportunity to go to college. In college, I met a girl from another school. She was a year younger than me. We got engaged. We were going to do all the right things. I waited till I got out of school and got a job. Waited till she got out of school, got a job. We got married. We'd saved up a bunch of money. We got back from our honeymoon. We made settlement on a house within weeks of getting back from our honeymoon. We bought a condo. I got a job with this little manufacturing company doing some sales and marketing for them. And I apparently had a little bit of a knack for that. By the time I was in my mid-early 20s, I was making a six-figure income. And for the next 12 years, it would just, it would go up by double-digit percentages every year. We had three beautiful kids. We bought a house that was bigger after that. I had a 38-foot boat. We had beautiful cars. My life was, you could say in a lot of ways, for me, I was living what you might describe as the American dream. At age 36, I would end up in my first rehab. And at age 41, I'd be living in a recovery house with 20 other guys. Now, what's wrong with this picture? Nothing in my life made me an alcoholic. Alcoholism is not circumstantial. What makes me an alcoholic is I have a mind that condemns me to drink, whether I want to or I don't, and I have a body that when I do pick that up, doesn't allow me to stop until it says I stop. This is an illness that is, we really say it's threefold: spiritual, mental, and physical. I think from, I look back now, and I can see from the time I was a young child, something wasn't right. I always had this thing, and I call it the thing that I describe as the thing I could never put my finger on it. And I remember even back as young as about three, maybe 4 years old, maybe five, but very young, and having this little routine that went on for a couple of years. And the routine was, I always felt, as that child, I always felt unsettled. I always felt that the thing I couldn't put my finger on, I would describe as, I was always bored. It was like, no matter what I was doing, I was bored. And in the dining room in our home, there was a piece of furniture that had drawers in it. One of the drawers was my drawer, and it had little junk toy stuff I got at the five and dime store and stuff I got in cereal boxes. And I had this routine where I would go, and I'd feel like I would open up this drawer, and it was almost like a deja vu type experience. It was like, I swore that there was a toy, there was something in that drawer that was going to make that feeling of boredom go away. I swear that it had been there before. I couldn't remember what it was, but I would go in the drawer and I would look for it. And I'd look and I'd look and I'd look and I'd look and I wouldn't find it. I'd close the drawer and 5 minutes later I'd come back. I'd open the drawer and I'd dump the drawer out and I'd look all over. And I could never find what that thing was. But it was like, even at that young age, it was like I was searching for something. It was like there's something that wasn't, you know, and I wasn't aware of this, but I look back now and I see it as clear as day. It was like there's something that just was missing, and I was already trying to find it somewhere. The book talks about how we're driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking. I was 7 years old, and I just had this fear, and I had a lot of fears. I mean, my life at that age was, you know, I think I couldn't put my finger on it, full of anxiety, and just I hated going to school. School was not a pleasant experience for me. And one of the things that I really hated about school, a very self-centered fear, was I hated to raise my hand and ask for the bathroom pass. And I just hated doing it. And even at that young age, you know, it talks about our lives being unmanageable. I don't believe that, to me, the unmanageability of the disease of alcoholism isn't what happens when I drank. Yes, my drinking was unmanageable, but the things that happened as a result of my drinking were consequences. The unmanageability was always trying to manipulate, always trying to fix that thing I couldn't put my finger on. And I had this fear of going to the bathroom. And at that age, I'm already the actor trying to make arrangements, set the lights, set the stage, set the ballet, set the orchestra. My mom knew the teacher's assistant. So I went to my mom and I said, I told her that, you know, the kids bothered me, it was a problem. And she goes to this woman and makes arrangements for me. So when I have to go to the bathroom, I go to Selma and I ask her. I go to Selma, she takes me to the bathroom, she makes sure there's nobody in there. She waits outside the door for me so nobody comes in and brings me back to class. Well, one day she's not there. And I wait as long as I can. I have to go to the bathroom. And I raise my hand thinking that everybody, I never notice when everyone else has to go to the bathroom. But when I have to go to the bathroom, of course, everybody's watching me. I go in, I open the door, there's nobody in there, thank God. I'm finishing up my business, and I hear the door open, and I'm like panic-struck. And I come out of the stall, and it's another kid from my class, 7-year-old kid. He's in the mirror, he's going like this, he's got a loose tooth. He turns to me and he says, oh, hi, or hey, I got a loose tooth. I beeline out of that bathroom, I go straight to the teacher, and I tell the teacher that, you know, he hit me, pushed me, said something he shouldn't have. A couple minutes later, this little kid comes walking back into the classroom. Teacher grabs him by the arm, walks him in front of the whole class, puts him in the corner, chastises him for what I said he did. And now, all of a sudden, I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, oh my God, 5 minutes, it's recess. Now, and the book talks about this fear, how we're driven by this fear. Now, I totally lied about what that kid did. I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm a liar, let me make something up about him. I was driven by the fear of me trying to manage that situation, trying to manage my life, trying to manage what was going on. The fear is this evil and corroding thread. Our very fabric of our lives is shot through with it. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which we feel we do not deserve, but did not yet we get the ball rolling. And there I am sitting there, thinking to myself, we're going to go to recess. He's going to tell everybody what I did. Everybody's going to hate me. Why do these things always happen to me? Now, that same 7-year-old boy that was driven by those fears would be the same little boy in a man's body that would pick his wife, that would pick his career, that would stay in his career for reasons of fear, would make major life decisions throughout his life based, driven by fear, and have no idea that that's what was happening in my life. I had my first drunk, at about 12 years old. Me and a buddy were coming home from school, and one of us said to the other, what do you want to do? One of us said, let's get drunk. I said, okay, let's do that. And we go back to his house. His dad was a single dad. He was at work. We sit down in front of that liquor cabinet, and it was a big drink. There was like maybe 6 bottles of booze in there. And, I take a couple swigs. My buddy takes a couple swigs. That's interesting. With two entirely different things happened to him and I that day. I take another swig. He takes another swig. He says, you know, I'm going to go in the kitchen. I'm going to make a snack. All right. He goes into the kitchen. In the 5 minutes, 10 minutes it takes him to make that snack, I go through every single one of those bottles two more times. Now, I was immediately drinking to overcome a craving beyond my control that I didn't realize what was happening. Another thing happened too. Tells us I think it's in the doctor's opinion that when we take a drink, it produces an elusive sensation, and we then can't differentiate the true from the false. But what is elusive? What is an elusive sensation? And elusive is something that's hard to find, hard to come by, something that you can't get. So I took those drinks, and an amazing thing happened to me. I remember like it was yesterday, sitting there, and after about three or four pops, looking around. And I'd been in this guy's, in my buddy's house 100 times. And looking around and just all of a sudden just noticing things like the curtains and how beautifully decorated the house was, and the carpet was so nice and the furniture. And it was like I had this overwhelmingly warm feeling of like, what a great friend. It's like, has anybody else in the world ever had a friend like this? See, the elusive sensation that it produced for me that day was the sensation of being okay. That thing I couldn't put my finger on for the first time in my life, unaware of this happening, was not there. I was in that present moment at that time for the first time, and it was a very profound moment. I mean, I look back on that, and whenever I tell the story, it's like I'm there. My friend calls out, snacks are ready. I walk into the kitchen. I projectile vomit all over the place. End up stumbling, you know, back home. I live like a half a block away. It takes me like an hour to get that half a block. You know, my mom comes home. And there's like lamps and furniture knocked all over the place because I fell all over. And she's like screaming, oh my God, what's the matter? I'm like, I'm drunk. You know, and I was so sick, I stayed home from school for 2 days. Now, you think that, you know, normally that would, now my buddy, that didn't happen to him. You know, what happened to him was, you know, he had a couple drinks. He went and made that. He didn't come back and get any more. Now, I don't know, you know, exactly what he experienced, but I'm thinking, you know, he probably was afraid maybe I'm going to get in trouble if my dad comes home or, you know, whatever. He didn't like the way it made him feel or taste or whatever it was. That was not my reaction. Later that spring, we would have opportunity to drink with the older kids, and you know, it's really the exact same thing happened to me again. It's like whenever I would get near it, it was just no control over what I could take. And I would ask myself, it was like, even remembering those early days, thinking to myself, God, what's wrong with me? Why does this happen to me? You know, and you know, as time would go by, I would get, I guess you could say, better at it. But you know, there would be those incidents would happen, and as you get into high school and college, you know, the incidents would start becoming more frequent. And I always would, the incidents would happen. I'd say to myself, it would always be like, God, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I felt like something was wrong with me. You know, that this kept happening, but I didn't know why or what it was. College, you go to a Baltimore Orioles game with the guys from the house that I lived in, and they're all fine. You know, I mean, I'm drinking our beers, and we have a cooler with gallons full of beer, and you know, we're in the cheap seats, and I'm rooting for the Oakland A's, and the people are throwing stuff at me, and I end up getting in a fight, and you know, security comes, and I end up fighting with security because security wants to take our beer. You know, that's not a normal reaction. You know, security gets the cops. The cops come. I flip the cop the bird and start running down the ramp. And I get back down about two ramps. I get tackled from behind. Get my heads pounded into cement a few times. Get thrown into Baltimore City Jail for a night. And my friends were they just walked away. It was like, you know, again, what's wrong with me? Why does this happen? Later on, I go to my boss's daughter's wedding. You know, it's like, I said to myself, my wife, you know, it's like, I got to be on my best behavior. I mean, this is not a time where you want to overdo it. You know, it's a few hours, just go, have a drink, just go. I mean, I was helped out before dinner. And so the incidents, and you know, and there were more graphic and more violent car wrecks and just things, you know, disorderly conduct arrests, and they would continue happening and get more frequent. But I think I got settled down a little bit, and I think, you know, my alcoholism was stretched out over a pretty long period of time before I really started going down, because I think I was able to sort of hold it at bay with some of my ambitions. You know, I did my first job, my first career, I was at for 18 years. And I think that I was able to sort of hold it at bay for a little bit, trying to accomplish certain things. I started traveling a lot for that job, and I'm drinking, you know, when I come home from work every night, I'm drinking 2 half gallons of gin during the week and one on the weekends. And at some point, my wife says to me, you know, you're really drinking a lot. You know, you really should just sort of maybe step it back a little bit. And she comes up with this plan that, you know, we're going to do, you're only going to drink 3 nights a week or 4 nights a week, you know, whatever it is. And she marks it on the calendar, here's the days that you're going to drink. You know, and I'm agreeable to this, trying to be the good husband. And the thing is, though, as soon as, this is the first time I have a little inkling that maybe something wasn't right. And as soon as she suggested that, it was like I couldn't drink how I wanted to and when I wanted to. It was like this panicked feeling came inside, and the bottles started getting hidden in the garage, and they started getting hidden in the trunk of the car. And you know, when she would leave the room on the nights that I could drink, it was like the freezer would open, and I'd get, it's real quiet, and fill the drink back up, and close the freezer before she'd come back in the room. So like I just had the one I was allowed to have that night, but I'd have it, you know, all night long for like 4 times. And I started traveling for work, and it just started getting out of hand. And when I would go away, you know, they'd send me out, you know, sometimes a day or two ahead of when I had my appointments and the business I had to conduct. So it was like I'd be out in you know, L.A., Chicago, New Orleans, it's all these, you know, the major cities across the country, and I'd be by myself, and it'd be like gloves off. You know, it's like I couldn't drink the way I wanted to anymore at home, but now here I am. And I would start getting into a lot of jams when I was out and having to do a lot of covering up of my tracks, and due to some, you know, various circumstances, at some point I ended up sort of with my back against the wall and ended up in my first rehab. And I always, at the job I had, I mean, the career, it really went well. Everybody there loved me. They respected me. You know, my family, everybody really liked me, but especially with that job, it was that fear driven. I always felt like I was inadequate. I always felt like I was a fraud. I felt like that I didn't go to the right school. I didn't take the right classes. I really didn't know what I was doing. All these things that are going really, really well, and the boss loving me and everything going just the way it should was going to all come crashing down at any second, and they were all going to be pointing at me and laughing at me, being like, ah, ha, ha, see, we knew it. We knew you didn't know what you were doing. And it was this fear inside. And I say that we talk about alcohol being really not the problem. The alcohol actually works very well for alcoholism for a long time, and it actually solved my problem for a long time. It gave me that elusive sensation of being okay. I would have never made it through that 18-year career had I not been able to drink and drink the way I did, because it got harder and harder and more difficult. Even though I had that job for as long as I did, in page 52 in the Bedevilments, it talks about a lot of the being a prey to misery and depression and all these things. It also talks about having difficulty making a living. Now, I didn't have a problem bringing home the paycheck. I didn't have a problem keeping the job. But going to work every day as year after year went by, and I was there for 8 years, 9 years, 10 years, 12 years, it got harder. That fear, that feeling of being a fraud, that feeling that they're all going to have me figured out, and trying to hide that and put on the face that I wanted everybody to see became more and more difficult, more and more exhausting, and more tiring. And it just became so painful to get out of bed every day and go to work. And I'd get to work and I'd make it through that day. The only thing that would get me through that day was that knowing at the end of the day there was a drink, and I would take that drink at the end of the day. And there's a line in Bill's story when the stock market crashes, and he said people are jumping off the high towers of finance, and he said, Bill said, I would never do anything like that. He said, besides, he goes into the bar, he has a drink or two, and that old fierce determination comes back. And that's what it was like. I'd just struggle and make it through the end of the day, and I'd get back and I'd take that drink and I'd be all right. I'd be like, okay, I do know what I'm doing. I am okay. And I'd make my plans, and I'd make my strategies, and I'd make it for the next day, and it would get me to that next day. And that got me through a lot of years without going nuts and leaving, you know, being losing my mind. I go to that work first rehab, and I get out, and I get back to back to work, and that was an awful thing, because then I really felt like that the gig was up. You know, I was like, now they must really think I'm a fraud, because I kind of blew it there like that, and they know, you know. And I was about 90 days sober, and I was so miserable. I mean, again, talk about being a prey to misery and depression, a feeling of uselessness, feeling of just fear, overwhelming fear and anxiety and depression. It was horrible. I couldn't take it. And it was coming up to Thanksgiving. I remember my wife saying to me, not understanding what alcoholism is about, saying, God, she's like, if you're going to be this miserable, she's like, why don't you just have one drink? And I was like, yeah, you know what? I think that's a good idea. You know, just I'm just gonna have one. You know, and I think that night I probably did manage to just have one, or maybe I probably snuck a second one in there, but I didn't overdo it that night. And that was another thing too. It was like throughout the years with the incidents, it was like the incidents were never predictable. You know, it was like it wasn't like that phenomenon of craving hit bang every single time I took a drink. You know, so that played a real mental game with me that, you know what? Last weekend, you had three or four drinks, and you were out with the neighbors and the friends, and you went out to dinner, and everything was fine. You know, you don't have a problem. And then I would do it fine the next weekend, or the next night, never nights in a row. But then all of a sudden, it was like out of nowhere, bam, it was like somebody hit a light switch, and I don't know why it would just be like on a tear. So, needless to say, after I had that drink, that would lead to more drinking, and I would end up in my second rehab again due to various circumstances. And at this point, my boss is starting to tell me, you know, he's like, you're going to blow it, you know, you're going to blow it. And I don't want to blow it. I don't want more than anything else in the world. I don't want to blow it. I have three beautiful kids now. They're all in a nice private school. I have, you know, the house. I've built this income from this company. It's not like I can just switch to another job if I lose it and you know, get the same income, because it was something I built from scratch. And I don't want to disrupt my kids' lives. I don't want to have them pull out of school. I don't want to lose our home. All those things will happen if I don't put this drink down. I end up at that second rehab, and I'm about 90 days sober, and I'm driving to work, and I remember just calling my wife and just hysteria. It was like, again, it was like at 90 days, it was like just the misery inside. The best I could do would get home from work every day, go up to the bedroom, and sit and read a book. I mean, I couldn't play with the kids. I couldn't talk with my wife. I couldn't function. And again, I was like, what's wrong with me? And I had spent years of my life, my adolescent, my teenage years, at this time, back and forth with therapists and psych meds, just trying to, why am I like this? Why am I so miserable? And I'm on my way to work, and I call my wife, and it's like, if this is what this is going to be like, it's like, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I can't take it. If this is what it's going to be like, I think I'd rather just be dead. And sort of threatened to kill myself, and again, to go into all this, you know, panic mode, and the doctors, and the change the meds, and try this, and try that. And needless to say, again, I would pick up a drink shortly after that. And now that the work is picking up a lot, I'm traveling all the time, and I can't drink. And at this point, I've now gotten to the point where I've sworn to myself over and over that I'm done. I know that the end, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm going to lose the house. The kids are going to have their lives uprooted. I'm going to lose my marriage. I'm going to lose everything. I don't want to do that. And it's amazing. The book says the baffling nature of alcoholism is the absolute inability to put it down, no matter how great the wish or the necessity. And I'm traveling, and one of these trips that I just popped into my head. Just if you just go to happy hour, just have a couple beers, you'll be fine. You got an appointment in the morning, just have a couple beers, go to bed early, and get up and go to your appointment. And that's what I set out to do. And those couple beers become three or four martinis, five or six martinis, it's closing time, and suddenly a thought popped into my mind, you know, you've never tried crack cocaine. And I'm in Miami, if when you decide you want to put it down, you can't give it up entirely, or when you take a drink, you have no control over the amount you take, or apparently what you take, you're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. I didn't know that. 4 days later, $4,000 later, two missed flights later, I make it back home. And somehow I managed to cover my tracks on that. Somehow, I mean, it was amazing how you can spin a tail. But I was able to cover that. And the first thing I thought when I got back and kind of got that behind me was, you can never do that when you're home. And then that thought quickly subsided to, well, you know, if you do that just a couple days a week, it's a good way to not drink. Which, as I, you know, don't need to go into a whole lot of detail, that became a couple days a week, became 5 days a week, became 7 days a week, around the clock, and all I was doing was that and drinking nonstop. And I got to a point where I crossed, I call two lines. I mean, there are a lot of lines I crossed, but there's two lines that were very distinctive in my mind. One was that I was going back and forth, you know, going, I still had the job, and I'm going and barely making it to work every day. And every day I'm waking up and I'm telling myself, today's the day. You got to stop this. You're going to lose everything. You can't do this to your kids. You cannot do this to your kids. And every day by noon, whatever it was, I would fail. And I guess I made a decision, and the decision I made, not realizing that there was another alternative, was that I was going to go on to the bitter end, trying to blot out my intolerable existence the best I could. And I basically gave up on the idea of trying to quit. I was like, I can't do that. It's not working. I've never, you know, every time you fail, just don't bother. This is what you were, you know, this is the way it was supposed to be. That would lead to 6 months of living in my car. And during that time, I would lose that job. My wife would throw me out. I would not be allowed legally within 100 yards of my home, and you know the house would go and everything would go. And I was 6 months into that. I crossed that second line, and that second line was I was just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop, and it didn't matter. I mean, when there were brief interludes in between of sobriety, I was just as miserable. When I was drinking, I was just as miserable. It just stopped working. It wasn't doing anything for me. And I reached that place it talks about where you know, I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it. And my mind said to me that, you know, this is the reason that all this has happened is because this is, you know, this is the, what you were really supposed to be, the reason you felt like a fraud, the reason that you know, your life has been so difficult, why it's been so hard for you. I've had that thing you can't put your finger on, because this is really what you were supposed to be all along. And if this is what you're going to do to your family, if this is what you're going to do to your children, if this is what you're going to do to your parents and everybody that loves you, you should just kill yourself. And I got bottles and everything else and got a hose and put it into the window of my car, and there I sat, sun going down, drinking and just waiting to pass out and fall asleep. And during this, all of a sudden something comes over me where I just tears just start flowing out of my eyes. And it was a very strange moment, because I mean, looking back on it, I don't associate any emotion with it. I don't remember feeling sad or grief or anything. It was just tears coming out of my eyes. And I cried out, God, what's wrong with me? And I fell asleep. And I woke up, the sun was coming up, and the car wasn't running. There was no reason why I should have woke up. And the first thing that popped into my mind when I woke up is that, you know what, you need to try one more rehab. You need to try one more detox. I hadn't had that thought in probably 8-9 months. And I would end up getting into a detox, and you know, they basically were saying, well, what do you want to do? And I explained, I've gotten out, I've gone home, I can't go home now, I don't know what to do. I thought I had tried meetings, I really didn't. They said, why don't you try a recovery house? And I said, fine. I didn't even know what a recovery house was. And I end up in this recovery house. And as with most, they have, you know, they had some rules. You know, you have to go through the 12 steps. You have to pick a fellowship. You have to get a sponsor. You have to get a commitment, get a job, that type of stuff. And I was there for, it was about 2 weeks. And I was outside of a meeting with some of the guys from the house. And I remember saying to the couple guys I was standing there with, you know, I've been here a couple weeks now. I don't have a sponsor. I really need to get a sponsor. And there was this young man sort of like right outside of where the little group we were standing in. I think he knew somebody I was talking to, and he overheard me. Kid was 19 years old. He was about 6'2". He was big. He was goofy. And it was like he had springs on his shoes. He like popped up into my face. He had a grin from here to here. And he's like, I'll sponsor you. And I remember I was looking him up and down. And I tell you, I thank God that I was just naive about this whole thing because I had no idea. I'm like looking at him and I'm thinking to myself that I'm old enough to be his father. And that a sponsor is somebody that, you know, bosses you around, runs your life, tells you what to do, you know, just basically takes over for you. I'm thinking, I can have the upper hand on him like that. I was like, okay. And we go over to, the next day he says, you know, come over, whatever, the day ever, come over to my house. And he was actually in one of the group of recovery houses in one of the other homes. He had 4 months sober. But the man had taken the time to take him through this book, word by word, step by step. And we get to his place and we sit down and he just starts talking to me. Starts talking to me about growing up. And he starts talking to me about how he felt when he was growing up. Now, he didn't use the words, that thing you can't put your finger on. But in his own way, he described what resonated with me is that thing you can't put your finger on. He felt the same way. And he talked about how he drank and the trouble he got in and the things that happened when he drank. The same things that happened to me. And in a 45-minute conversation, he went from this kid I was going to have the upper hand on to somebody that I could see there was something clearly different about him that I was willing to listen and trust in him to tell me what to do. We opened up the book and we started reading the doctor's opinion and talking about the allergy in a line that just still, it still to this day resonates with me. It gives me a smile every time I see it. It talks about the physical allergy that when we take that drink, we react abnormally. We don't have the ability to control how much we take. And it says in there, it says that it explains for many things for which we otherwise could not account. And there were so many things in my life that for I could not otherwise account that I would ask myself time and time again, what's wrong with me? Now, 2 weeks earlier, 3 weeks earlier, I was in my car and I cried out to God, what's wrong with me? Now, I was not brought up in a religious household. We didn't talk about God. My prayers prior to that had always been to myself, how can I get myself out of this? Who can I call? I cried out to God, and 3 weeks later, he puts a 19-year-old kid in my life that opened up this book, and for the first time in my life, he shows me what's wrong with me. I knew what was wrong with me, and I was willing to do anything that he said from then on. And we went through this process very quickly. I mean, went through within 6 weeks, I was making amends. I remember saying that third step prayer and then, you know, him explaining that it's a decision and really seeing there that we would have a new employer. And that decision is, do you want this new employer? Do you want to stop playing God and do you want to be? And in a very, you know, now to me, it just seems, sometimes we overcomplicate this, but it was just so simple. I mean, I went, did that prayer, and I remember walking home that night and just feeling, I felt something. It was just a sense of relief. It was like, yeah, maybe this could work for me. Maybe this could work for me. And doing that fourth step, you know, and then if I'm the third step, I'm signing up for that, you know, that new job. You know, the fourth step to me, it was like writing, you know, it was like printing out basically a job application, a resume, except for putting all the great things about me. I actually got honest and took a real close look at myself. And then that fifth step, you know, it was like an interview between God and myself and another human being. And we sat down, we did that, you know, after that, we sent me in the room, I sat for a half an hour quietly, and we came out and we did that seven-step prayer, which was, to me, it was like sort of the swearing into the job. It's the consummation of the process. Do you want that job? You know, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness, the job that I agreed to go through the motions, take the actions to be able to accept the usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here, right now, to do your bidding. It's the job. You're hired. He's like, you know, to me, it was like, you're on board. Let's go. We got work to do. You know, and then the rest of the work, that was like cleaning out the inside, you know, cleaning out that vessel so God's love could fill it. You know, faith without works is dead. You know, that vessel was cleared out. It was filled with God's love. But in order for it to stay fresh and stay vital, it needs to be tipped over and it needs to be poured out. But there was wreckage that had to be cleared so that it could pour. And that was the amends process. I would be able to, you know, and it's not always, sobriety isn't always, you know, every bit of it. And I think a lot of times we come up here and we say how wonderful everything is all the time. There was a lot that was very difficult. At about 12 months, I remember my wife was still, I mean, she was just so angry. And I had made amends to her for the debauchery and the all the money and the, you know, losing the house and all those things. And but she was still angry. She was still really resentful. And I would get phone calls 4 or 5 times a week from her, and she would just be screaming and just saying really nasty, hurtful, mean things. And my reaction would be to let me see if I could scream louder and something more hurtful than you scream. And it would just be back and forth. And it occurred to me that, you know, your sponsor taught you better than this, that in the fourth step there's a prayer for this, that, you know, we have to master these resentments. We can't be angry. You know, I need to treat this person as if they're a sick person. And she was sick, you know, like ourselves. They perhaps are sick as well, you know, and probably she was a lot sick because of me. And it's funny, I took, and I realized that I wasn't practicing that. And I actually took my phone and I changed her name to like ourselves. I have it. It's that way to this day. Every time the phone would ring, it would come up like ourselves, and I would say that prayer to myself. This is a sick person. You know, I wouldn't treat a sick friend by being angry at them. And she'd call and she'd be screaming and yelling, and I would just be silent. And when she was done, I'd say, "Vic, what's the matter? What's wrong? How can I help?" And it'd be like, she didn't know what to say. The first time I said it, it was like silence. And she's like, "Well, you know, Alexander has ballet at this time, and Samantha, I need to sign her up for soccer, and I don't have the money, and James has to be here at football practice, and I got to do this, I got that." I said, "I can pick him up. I can take him there." I said, "I can give you an extra $50, you know, in your next support check, you know, towards the, you know, for the soccer." That, and again, it was like silence. You know, and I'm going to tell you that those phone calls stopped immediately. But I started taking that approach, saying that prayer, using the kit of spiritual tools that was laid at my feet, actually picking them up, putting the tool belt on, and using the tools rather than stepping over them. And the calls went from 3 a week to 2 a week to, over a period of time, those calls have completely subsided. At about 18 months, we were able to hold on to the house for a little while. I was able to, you know, through work and give support. Her parents were able to give her money, but it just fell apart, and the house had to go. It was sell or foreclose. And she was fortunate enough, she was able to sell it. And I was set with the task of grabbing a couple guys from the old recovery house I lived in and renting the truck and having them pack up the truck and bring their stuff to storage, because they didn't know where they were going to go at this point with the dog. They hadn't been able to find a place. They were going to stay with their parents temporarily. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, I remember that night before thinking, you know, picking up that truck and bringing it back and just praying that, you know, "God, give me the strength. I don't have the guts to go and face this. You know, to take my kids and put their stuff in a truck and put it in storage and have them leave their home. I don't have the strength. God, please help me with this." And I remember waking up the next morning and not feeling any better about it and being really angry at God. "How come you're not helping me here? How come you're not helping me?" And I would go, and we got through that day. We got it all done, and the truck's pulling away. My two little girls and my son, he took off because he was angry and resentful. He blamed it all on my wife. It wasn't her fault, but he blamed it all on her. My two little girls are 8 and 10 at the time, and the truck's pulling away, and we're standing there, and they're crying, they're sobbing. They're saying, "Daddy, we don't want to leave our house. We don't want to leave our room." You know, and it was the only house they ever knew. And I didn't have any magic words for them. I didn't have anything that I could say that was going to make it all better. You know? But at that moment, I think my prayer was answered on a couple levels. I think for the first time in my life, I think I experienced pure compassion, because what I felt was their pain. didn't have anything to do with me. It was their pain. And I was able to be there and just be there and be present with them. I showed up and I was there. See, the old Dave would have been like, at least if not verbally in his mind, don't you know how I feel about this? I've been trying to stay sober. I've been trying to prevent this. Do you know how this makes me feel? That never crossed my mind. And the other thing that never crossed my mind that night before, the old Dave would have taken a drink. He would have never shown up with that truck. Now, for the first time, I think I could have said that having been recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body was true in my life that day. I was hearing another man's fifth step at about 3 years. And he was talking about how he felt around his family and that he didn't feel in place, and he had some amends he had to make and just the awkwardness of it. And it didn't really have anything necessarily to do with it, but it's an amazing thing when you're at the other side of the table, when you're hearing somebody else's fifth step and when you're going through somebody's fourth step, the things that God, between God, yourself, and another human being, there's still three of you there, whether you're listening or you're on either side of the table. And it hit me like a bag of bricks. See, at this point, my wife, even though we had the phone calls had subsided, I would go to their place to her family's for Christmas Day because it was what, it was good with my kids, and it was very awkward, very uncomfortable. Her parents, she was nice enough to have me there, and it meant a lot to the kids, and I always showed up. I'm doing this fifth step, and it hits me like a bag of bricks that even though I had made amends to her for losing the house and the money and the things that happened, that really wasn't what I truly owed her an amends for. I realized all of a sudden that when my son was in first grade, and this was long before anybody would have even suggested that I should go to a rehab, although I was suffering inside from alcoholism very badly, that he had had a lot of learning disabilities and emotional problems, and we had had him tested, and they wanted to put him into a certain class, special class. We had him tested. My wife was an educator. We had him tested independently. And the placement that they were putting him in, they were putting him there because that was all they had. It wasn't the correct placement. So what we had to do is we ended up having to go to an arbitration with the school district. We had to hire an attorney. It cost $50,000, $60,000 for the attorney. And if we lost this, it would all be out of our pocket. And I remember saying to my boss, to my family, to the neighbors, how I don't care. I'll spend anything. I don't care. We'll put the house on the line. This is my son. I'll do anything. It doesn't matter. This is for him. And we go through this arbitration. The verdict comes back and it's not for us. It's against us. And we, on the way home, there's silence in the car. And we get into the house, and my wife comes to me like she wants comfort. She wants me to hold her. She wants me to hug her. And I say to her, "This is your fault. You wanted this." And that was the nicest thing I said. I mean, I reached in, I ripped out her heart, I cut her down at the knees, and I walked out and I did yard work and I drank myself into an oblivion. Things were never the same between her and I after that day, ever. And I went back after hearing that fifth step and this occurring to me and said to her, I said, "Vicki," I said, "that day that was the worst thing I could have possibly done. I was so very wrong." I said, I had never given her credit. She was a stay-at-home mom. I'd never given her credit for the job it was, that it was worth anything. And I told her, I said that, that was so wrong of me, what I did. It was not your fault. And I said, you're an excellent mother, and I appreciate everything you've done. That Christmas, when we went to her family's, and at this point I started dating a woman, and went with them. We played games, we sang songs, we had the nicest time. And I can tell you, as a result of that amends, not only did it change her attitude towards me, it changed her attitude towards me with my girls and my son, and it changed the attitude of them, it changed the attitude of her entire family. And we had the nicest time that Christmas, and I can tell you that I never felt more at home or more comfortable with that family, even during the 15 years that I was married to her in that family, than I did that day as a result of making that amends. I had this friend, Paul. I was friends with him since I was 7 years old, and as we were growing up, we used to go down to the Jersey Shore with each other's families. We'd go down for 2 weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time. This one summer, we were about, I don't know, 12 years old. We go down and we meet these two girls, these two sisters, and we're hanging out with them. And we would, every summer, we'd go down and we'd hang out with these sisters, these two girls, and they became, you know, good summer friends of ours. And the one girl I had a real crush on, and the one summer, you know, her and I made out on the beach, and it was, you know, it was like teeny bopper stuff, and we went, you know, played, hung out at the arcade, and all looked at each other. And my friend Paul, he used to come and stay with me when I had my boat. He used to come and stay on the boat, and there's he would always get there late on a Friday night. He wouldn't get there till like 11:30, 12 o'clock, and he'd be like, oh, well, I stop in Ocean City first. There's these friends I met there, Tim and Sue. They have this place called the Tiki Bar. He said, you really should come sometime. And I never did. And during the time when I was in you know, my full-blown alcoholism, Paul and I lost touch for a lot of years. But Paul was always a good friend. I mean, even during that time, he never judged me. He was always just a friend. And about 3 years into sobriety, I get a call from Paul. And he says, you know, my brother has a place down in Ocean City. Why don't you come down? His family's not going to be down this weekend. Why don't you come down? I'll introduce you to Tim and Sue and all that. And I had to do what the book says, because Paul drinks. He's not an alcoholic. Tim and Sue, you know, they were going to a place called the Tiki Bar. It's like a little hut in their backyard, and they have a hot tub. I had to do what the book said. The book, you know, the book says, you know, what are your motives for going there? You know, or do you have good reason for going there? And I was able to answer that question honestly, that yes, it's a lifelong friend, and I want to spend, you know, I want to get reacquainted, spend some time with my friend. And and it says, are you on firm spiritual ground? And yes, I mean, I was sponsoring people, I was practicing this design for a living, you know, I was in service, I was, you know, all the right answers were there. So I went with the intent of bringing something to the occasion. And we get there, we get to the Tiki Bar, and there's a couple other people there. There's this woman there. We're talking, we're hanging out, and the next day we all go on a canoe trip together, and I'm in the boat with this woman. And after that summer, I start, you know, talking to her, and we start hanging out, and the next thing you know, we start dating. And this woman is a very heavy drinker, to say the least. As we start dating, I get a call one day from her that she got a DUI. So I spend the next 6 months driving her around as I watch her alcoholism start progressing very quickly. And while we're doing it, she's asking me a lot of questions about AA, about what I do, you know, what's going on. She knows that, you know, that I used to drink and now I don't. And I'd answer her questions, and usually ask me them when she was drunk, and she'd ask me the same questions again the next time. But I would just answer the question, never suggest you should go to AA, or I think you're an alcoholic. and then I get a call from her. She says that, you know, she's like, I have to take Xanax every day to go to work. I have this anxiety. I can't stop drinking. She's like, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to detox. She gets out of detox. We start going, you know, going to meetings together. A few years later, her and I get engaged. 2.5 years ago, her and I got married. She's just celebrated 6 years of sobriety. And she's the girl that I kissed on the beach when I was 13 years old. So, I tell that story, one, because it's a cool story, I think. And two, just to say that it's not a matter of, I don't think, oh, yeah, wow, that must have been God's will that we met. You know, I don't think that. And I don't think that I got her sober. I mean, I maybe perhaps bear witness a little bit. She has brothers and sisters in AA, so it's not that she wasn't familiar with it. But the book tells me that I can be a free man, that I am free to go and do whatever I want as long as I'm practicing these principles and I'm on firm spiritual ground. And it tells me that I should be, wherever I should be, I should go to a place where I should be, I can be of maximum service to others. I don't know where that is. I don't know. I'm not God. I don't know where I should be to be of maximum service. But I do know that the book tells me what I believe is God's will for me. And it tells me, because of my experience as an alcoholic, that I am uniquely qualified to help another alcoholic. And to me, that is very clearly what God's will is for me, as well as the demonstration of these principles in my respective home and occupation. And if I am, my goal in life is to wake up every morning and to ask God, you know, how can I best do your will? And when I start every day and live every day with that attitude, whether I had gone to see my friend Paul that weekend or I had gone somewhere else, I would not have been in the wrong place. It doesn't matter. When you're trying to do God's will the best you can, you can't be in the wrong place.